ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's just your average suburb, but there's a whiff of someone playing silly duckers. Reg Grundy's kids' clothes and stuffed toys are going missing.
It's Leonardo da Vinci.
Hi, I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and I've secured an interview with Leonardo da Vinci, the criminal cat, thieving mastermind, for my podcast series, Nature's Most Wanted.
What the duck?
On ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump blinks and the world breathes a sigh of relief for now.
Is this a reprieve or the end that the world has been waiting to see?
Is it a pause or is it statecraft in action?
Well, our next guest knows state power plays and war games better than most.
And how to resolve them.
This episode of Global Roaming, we speak to one of the UK's leading military and war analysts.
Those words from Donald Trump, Latika, a whole civilization will die tonight, I think actually really breathed genuine fear into many people's hearts and minds, and I don't just mean in the exact theatres of war, unless Iran reached some sort of deal on opening the Straits of Hormuz. And now this morning, just a few hours before we're going to air now, we suddenly heard that there was to be a two-week pause announced, I think, by the Pakistanis. Is that correct, Latika?
So interestingly, Geraldine, I'd been hearing some whispers from some of my US sources that a ceasefire might be on the way. And then there were bits and pieces emerging online, some positive signals from the Pakistani PM. And then, just as you say, we're coming on air and Donald Trump posts on Truth Social the following. Based on conversations with Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and Field Marshal Asim Manir of Pakistan, and wherein they requested that I hold off the destructive force being sent tonight to Iran and subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, this is capitals, immediate and safe opening, end capitals, of the Strait of Hormuz, I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks. This will be a double-sided capitals ceasefire, end capitals. The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives and are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term capitals, peace with Iran, and capitals again, peace in the Middle East. We received a 10-point proposal from Iran and believe it is a workable basis on which to negotiate. Almost all of the various points of past contention have been agreed to between the United States and Iran, but a two-week period will allow the agreement to be finalised and consummated. On behalf of the United States of America as president and also representing the countries of the Middle East, it is an honour to have this long-term problem closed to resolution. Thank you for your attention to this matter, President Donald J. Trump.
Okay, as I sort of prepared to do an emergency episode today, it just seemed to me, I thought, look, I think the superpower is going to have to blink one way and the other because we just, you know, this is a really parlous situation to be in. And it took my mind to when superpowers have blinked. And of course, I remember that Obama blinked, if you recall. He drew that red line during the Syrian war and said, cross this line where they started to use chemical weaponry and, you know, all hell will break loose, he said in a much more Obama way. And he did not carry it through. Now, a lot of people marked him down for that very thing. They said he blinked and he shouldn't have blinked. But he was worried about an air war with the Russians. And as people said to me, the Russians knew they wouldn't win that air war and they wouldn't have gone because they were supporting the Syrians and they wouldn't have flown their planes. But we don't know. Obama said, I'm not prepared to take that risk. And similarly, Reagan withdrew from Lebanon in 1983. They'd sent a whole peacekeeping force to try to escort the PLO out of Lebanon. It was really during the Lebanese Civil War. It was a very controversial decision by Reagan. And And they were blown up. 220 Marines were blown up by two suicide bombs, masterminded by Islamic Jihad and the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence. And he withdrew unilaterally, Reagan did, from Lebanon. And so that, so their two, now, you know, their two accounts of a superpower effectively saying, I'm out of here. Is that how we can imagine Trump might behave in the face of what he's discovering is a much more defiant Iran than he imagined?
Look, I think there's a couple of things to read into this. One is this language he uses about bringing this to a close, this long-term problem close to resolution. Now, I can see a world where if this does spark back up or Iran is a problem to its neighbours again, and we know that it would only take Iran a drone or making passage difficult for a ship or two, that the Americans say, sorry, we resolved this. We're not interested in fixing this anymore. And last time we tried, you weren't all there with us. And then this other line, subject to, as you rightly questioned, Geraldine, subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, immediate and safe opening. Now, those three phrases there are in capitals. So
it is still, it's provisional.
I think there's room here for Iran to play, you know, mischief. And I also think there's enough room in that statement for Trump to say, I've declared victory, all my objectives are done, I'm gone, I'm out of here.
Well, look, it is interesting. The other thing that strikes me is that there's the complete lack of big diplomatic characters on the stage. You know, where are the Kissingers, the Brzezinskis, the James Bakers at this point? You know, we desperately need them to come in. I mean, Witkoff and Kushner, for instance, I mean, you know, really, they're not in the same class. Now, this is when you do need them and you wake up to news like we heard with the civilizational business and you think, gosh, we really need help here. And it's not, you know, necessarily help from the air. The other point that's been made to me when I quickly sought some advice this morning is Iran has got to be careful not to overplay its hand too. Now, listeners might say, oh, they seem to be able to get away with anything at the moment. But if they did provoke the Americans to really shatter their bridges and their power plants, et cetera, et cetera, that would be, in effect, a loss. Even for utterly committed people like the Iranian regime turns out to be, or the people, whoever is governing it at the moment, that would be, you'd mark that as a loss. So the idea that they've got carte blanche, which looks like that in some ways at the moment, I don't think it's completely right to see it like that.
I'm very intrigued to hear what the Pakistanis say. They've obviously played a key role here. And by the way, if this does even last 2 weeks, what a remarkable achievement for Pakistan to get these two sides to agree to anything as the economy is being held hostage. But we can't divorce all of this from the two particularly menacing tweets that Donald Trump has sent over the last 2 days. One, he posts on Easter Sunday, telling the Iranians to effing open the straits, you crazy bastards. Are we allowed to say that word on the ABC? and telling them they'll all be in hell if they don't. And then today, an absolutely extraordinary one.
Oh, that was a shocking. Yep.
Correct. Wipe the civilization.
I think that's really an unforgivable way to speak, to be candid.
We have crossed the Rubicon, Geraldine. Trump comes out and says, which I think he will, all these tweets that you were all having a go at me for, this was all part of my art of the deal. This was me negotiating. See, I got the best deal for us.
But it's not New York real estate. This, you know, you've got to realize that.
Yes, exactly. He will have justified threatening. I mean, you know, in anyone's book, there are a lot of legal experts saying this intent that he portrayed in the second tweet today, that could constitute genocide.
Yep.
Attacking civilian infrastructure can be justified under international law if it's got dual use.
Sure.
But certainly every single bridge, you would say that that's potential for a war crime. Even if they're threats, empty threats, we have certainly crossed a line here, and it's going to make it much, much harder for Western governments and those powers that believe in a rules-based order or whatever
or any rules, you know,
remains to say that you can't do this.
No, I mean, I did have moments of genuine fear today. I mean, I thought, wow, this is seriously escalating in a way that, look, I'm of an age, I was a little girl, but I can remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I can remember how afraid I was. It was a very big discussion in my household, and I was genuinely afraid as a child that something was way beyond anybody's control. And I had that moment today of thinking, you know, are we anything like this? But look, this is a perfect territory for our guest, Dr. Jack Watling, one of the world's really most highly respected military strategists. He's based at the Royal United Service Institute in London with a lot of experience on the ground in the world's most intractable conflicts. We've had him on before, 2 years ago, I'm delighted to say, on Global Roaming. He's just published a book called Statecraft, The New Rules of Power in a Divided World. And he just seems to be the perfect guest at this super tense, fragile moment in the world order. Here he is now, Jack Watling. Jack Watling, a big welcome back to Global Roaming.
It's good to be back with you.
You say in your analysis, Jack, that there's always a balance between the military priorities and the objectives and the political priorities in managing wars. So what are the overriding objectives that the Iranians would need to see in order to agree to a ceasefire? And the same for the United States. Where are there the biggest points of difference, but also where are the biggest points of overlap where you could possibly see a way through here?
Well, so if we look at the military briefers in the US, they've defined a much narrower set of objectives, which is the destruction of Iran's ballistic missile production and its arsenal, the destruction of the Iranian Navy, and damage to the nuclear program. The nuclear program is slightly harder, but the other ones are eminently achievable. And we could hit a situation where the US essentially says we have inflicted the damage against the things that we wanted to. And so we can cease operations at this point. The Iranians would still contest the Straits. Their main interest is, as I say, showing that they can inflict sufficient pain in response to somebody attacking them, that the fear of that pain prevents people from attacking Iran again in the future. Right? So they need the pain to be felt, but they also want to essentially withdraw from having to be in a confrontation, not only with the US, but with everybody else that relies on that strait, right? Because they are actually only hurting the US indirectly through their effect on prices. There's a lot of collateral damage. That would be manageable, but Donald Trump has also articulated the desire to achieve regime change. He has argued that he wants to control who the next supreme leader is and appointments in the Iranian government. And he said that he wants to control the flow of oil. Those are all things that are completely unacceptable. Now, it's plausible that the US would walk back on those objectives. I think that's entirely within Donald Trump's frame of behavior, that he throws out positions and then abandons them quite freely. But what I don't think he would abide is the optics of the Iranians being able to claim some kind of victory.
So he doesn't want to scurry away, that the result must not be that he looks like he's in an undignified retreat.
That's, I think, fundamental to his ability to settle, yes.
On the nuclear point that you raised, how realistic and achievable is this idea of going in to extract the uranium?
It would be theoretically possible to use air power to create a cordon around a particular area and get a large number of troops onto that objective. But you would need to stay there for some time, and it would be thousands and thousands of troops involved. And you would take casualties, right? And the biggest challenge would not necessarily be getting there, but extracting them. We've seen, I mean, if you look at the two C-130Js, so military transport planes, four military helicopters, and a Reaper uncrewed aerial vehicle that the US lost in the process of extracting one airman. So around $300 to $500 billion worth of invested equipment. Then you can appreciate that if you're trying to extract thousands of people, it's in some ways you get economies of scale, but it's not a simple proposition.
In your judgment, can forget the nuclear extraction, can the strait be opened without big casualties?
If the US decides to militarily open the strait, they will conduct a very extensive set of strikes on all of the locations where the Iranians might use missiles to attack shipping. Then you will have to have naval ships transit the strait to conduct mine clearance and to start escorting civilian shipping through. Those ships can probably shoot down drones, but normally there are 100 ships a day that are transiting that strait. In this context, you know, you're not going to be able to escort that many. And so you'll have a reduced flow at very, very high cost. The amount of time the naval ships remain there, they are exposed to risk. And so if they remain there indefinitely, at some point, a naval vessel is going to be hit by something. And of course, there's always the risk that something like an LNG tanker, pressurized liquefied natural gas tanker, is hit. And then you have a huge issue. And so there will be a residual threat to shipping. It can be brought down to a certain level, but it can't be eliminated unless there is some kind of political solution. The other aspect is that there are a number of islands that the Iranians operate from that are overlooking the strait, and the US may feel that it needs to capture those. Again, it's militarily doable, but it means large numbers of US troops being deployed into hostile territory. From an insurance point of view, many insurers will find this a very unattractive proposition. And if the ships aren't insured, when you're looking at how much money is held in those hulls, it would be catastrophic for any business to lose one. And so just on those terms, there will need to be a parallel political process.
I know you have some insight into how and why military decisions were made to strike Iran behind the scenes, Jack. Could you give us an insight into the sort of unfolding, I think it's a fair thing to say, unfolding power play between the US and Israel as the war continues? And I might add, you also, in another podcast, I heard you say that, in fact, part of the business of keeping Russia on side for the US is so that in any possible China war, Russia doesn't play a role, which was the first time I'd heard that articulated quite like that. So on both those really very important issues, could you offer us how your thoughts are developing?
Sure. So I think we have to acknowledge that in Washington, there isn't a single united policy planning process at the moment, right, until you get to the president. And so when we talk about lines of strategic thinking, you're talking about a minority view within the community, policy community in Washington. But there is a very, very strong position from the defense establishment, which is that it is plausible that the US will end up in a direct confrontation with China in the near future. And if that happens, then the ledger looks pretty daunting if it's just the US versus China. If it's the US versus China, Russia and Iran and Venezuela, then the problem starts to look extremely uncomfortable for the US. And so there is a desire to desynchronize these threats, essentially. In the case of Russia, as you alluded to, the US can't knock them out of the game. And so because of nuclear escalation risk, and so there is a desire to build them back into economic relations with the West.
Play nice.
To play nice and give the Russians the option of sitting it out. Now, if that fails, then the other side of the policy is to try and browbeat Europeans into basically taking on that problem so that Russia is fixed there and can't run flank interference on the US confrontation with China. In the case of Iran, the US is not particularly dependent on the Strait of Hormuz. It's actually a much bigger problem for China if China can't get the oil from there. So within this community, the Strait of Hormuz is not necessarily seen as the key issue, but Iran's ballistic missiles, their navy, and other capabilities were seen as a potential threat to US sea lines of communication, and therefore the writing down or destruction of those things was considered a desirable objective. Now, completely separate to that, there is a part of the US policy community that sees itself in a struggle with Iran and has been since the Islamic Revolution in 79, and has a visceral emotional dislike of the Iranians, and has wanted to conduct military operations against them for decades.
As have the Israelis.
The Israeli position is slightly different because it's, I don't think it's an emotional dislike. The Israelis, in many ways, respect the Iranians and admire their tenacity. But Iran has been the focal point of a coalition of actors threatening Israel for some time. And therefore, they see their own national security interests as, you know, tied up with the ability to write down or destroy Iran's capacity to strike them. And in this instance, they see the US president's proclivity to engage in such a military operation as an opportunity. And so the Israelis are trying to damage the regime in a manner which will permanently or for a very, very long time degrade its capacity to strike Israel.
Jack, you obviously saw the Easter Sunday message from Trump to the Iranians, whom he called, amongst other things, crazy bastards. Do you think that is just more rhetoric? Do you think it's more of Trump setting out these positions, as you described before, that he might abandon freely? Or do you think this is telling us something more about the state that the US is actually in this war?
And I'm terribly sorry to intervene, but the thought that he actually mentioned the possibility of targeting desalination plants, Jack, which I would have thought was actually not only against all international law, but I think even against their own constitutional, the way they were talking about it, that was an extraordinary line cross, I thought, and I wonder how you heard it.
Well, I think the Trump administration embarked on this war without outlining a legal basis for the operation. There's been a few retroactive explanations, but fundamentally this is a war launched without a legal explanation of what the causa belli was, which would be the textbook definition of a war of aggression, right? So firstly, we're already in the territory of somebody who doesn't even pay lip service to, pays less lip service than the Russians, in fact, to
civilian targets.
It's to adherence to international law, right? Then you get into the question of what you target. And in this instance, threatening to attack desalination plants will have a catastrophic effect on the civilian population. And the logic of doing it is that inflicting harm on the civilian population will create some kind of pressure on the Iranians or their ability to govern such that they change their position on the Straits of Hormuz, right? So this is coercion. It is using civilians as a mechanism of coercion. That is precisely the logic of bombing civilians during the Second World War, right? That if you break the will of the civilian population, you will build pressure on the government to desist in their war effort. And that's precisely what we tried to get rid of through the UN Charter and through updates to the Geneva Conventions following the Second World War. So this is a rejection of the Second World War international legal system, which when you have two members of the permanent members of the Security Council, Russia and the US, who are now in a consensus about this being how the world works, really means that international legal order is dead in the water. And we need to acknowledge that. We need to be realistic about the fact that it's not going to come back in the way that we would have liked, and think pretty deliberately about how we establish norms of behavior in the future. So, this is non-trivial. There are plenty of US officers who do believe in the laws of armed conflict, think that it protects them as well, and may well take a lot of those things off the targeting list, right? So there will be an argument inside the US government, and it's important to acknowledge that they haven't struck those things yet.
Yeah, you just answered my question, because I thought there was a kind of carve-out for dual use. When they suspect it's dual use, they can justify it and it's not a war crime. And I think that's what the US would wrap themselves in, right?
I'm absolutely sure that they will come up with a legal explanation as to why what they did was fine. But normally, that is something you do before you conduct the action, right? The legal process of justification is not a PR exercise. It's a fundamental part of deciding what you can and can't do beforehand. In this instance, we're seeing action first and then the lawyers catch up. And that's not how the system should work.
So just to pick up on your final observation there about this international order being dead, how we all respond to that, I totally agree with you. But one of the difficulties this has exposed is the fracturing of the relationship between the allies. Europeans don't want to join this war. Australia has sent a small contribution through the request of the Gulf, so notably not the United States. It did support the war initially. And the UK is not, and so have a lot of European partners. Where does that leave the alliance? And what would you be saying to the British government about how to navigate this forward? Because I think there is a consensus that they made a mistake in not initially supporting or allowing the US to use the bases, something the UK has fixed. Where does it go from here?
No, again, it wasn't a mistake. The US didn't explain what the legal basis for the operation was, right? So normally they would explain and then they'd get permission. If they don't even present the case, then you have a problem. And the UK did not want to become a co-belligerent in a war where it had no participation in the planning or even an understanding of the objectives, yeah? Especially since we have a major threat on our own doorstep and this is acting directly against our own interests in terms of our ability to deal with the threat from Russia. And so, Europeans don't want to be a part of this. And Trump blows hot and cold on this, right? One day he says that we don't need you anyway. Nothing that you could provide would be useful. And the next day he says it's on us to fix it. And so when the ask is undefined, but the demand flick-flacks back and forth between yes and no on a 24-hour basis, that is not the context in which you kind of say, yeah, actually, we're just going to sign a blank check and come in with you on this. So I think Europeans will look at this and they will work out what their own interests are. It's separate from NATO, right? This is outside the North Atlantic area. It doesn't really affect the treaty. The US hasn't...
But Trump has conflated it.
Trump has conflated it, but we're heading towards the NATO summit in Ankara. A number of allies are making less progress than people would like towards the capability targets that have been set. And so Trump has found that threatening to withdraw is probably the most successful way of coercing European allies to move on spending. And in that context, he is going over his favorite tracks. And we shouldn't conflate that with a serious demand for Europeans to do much in the Gulf. I mean, what is he hasn't even really specified what he's asking us to do. And this is complex airspace. There needs to be a lot of deconfliction. You saw what happened between the Kuwaiti Air Force and the US Air Force, where you had three US Air Force jets shot down by friendlies. That's the kind of thing that can happen when you don't have adequate planning. So unless we can define what the ask is, we can't even make the decision.
Thank you very much. It was lovely to talk again.
Likewise.
You're great. Thank you so much.
Global.roaming at abc.net.au is where you can write to us. And we love the feedback and it does honestly guide us to where we head next. It's a way for us to find out what you're thinking and what you're curious about, terrified by maybe. So please do get in touch.
And you can listen at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. weekdays on ABC Radio National and anytime at all on ABC Listen.
Bye-bye for now.
See you, Geraldine.